Good afternoon. Scott Spears back with you here for the second hour of the program today, Wednesday, March the 14th, 2018, 13 minutes past the hour. And we have got a great guest this hour, a first-time visitor to this program, but a conversation that is going to be extraordinary. So everybody will want to listen. So run and get everybody and pull them up next to the radio or whatever device you are listening on at this time. Before we get to our guest, I do want to remind you that tomorrow, Thursday, 12:15 p.m., we're going to be joined by David Newell, who was Mr. McFeely on the TV series Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, which this year is celebrating 50 years since its first episode, which went on in February of 1968. David will be on at 12:15 tomorrow, Thursday, to make a special announcement you're not going to want to miss. So don't forget that. And today, of course, is National Pi Day, 3.14 National Pi Day. And here's a little trivia to trick somebody on. Why is it National Pi Day? Because it's March the 14th, 3.14. See if they get that. But of course, a lot of people are giving away pies today, so whichever pie you like, it is National Pie Day. This hour, as I said, we've got a great guest and a great conversation that people should be having all throughout the country. Our guest this hour is Dr. Gary Small. He is the director of the UCLA Longevity Center and the author of a great new book, Snap: Change Your Personality in 30 Days. Such a pleasure to welcome to these microphones Dr. Gary Small. Dr. Small, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing well. Good to talk with you. How is the weather out in California?
It's beautiful today. We had a bit of rain the last couple days, but we definitely need that.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people said today about the passing of Stephen Hawking. Did he mean anything to you in your career?
Well, you know, I think these inspirational individuals have a huge impact on people like myself, and it certainly is something quite interesting because I think in some ways these icons shape our personalities to some degree because they are people we look up to and admire.
Somebody was saying to me this morning, as everybody know, Stephen Hawking certainly had some tremendous physical limitations. He lived into his mid-70s. He must have had a great spirit inside.
Well, certainly, you know, an individual's spirit shapes who they are, and Stephen Hawking is just such an example of someone who has prevailed over physical adversity and illness. And, you know, in SNAP, we talk about the genetic aspect of personality, how for most of the, for actually all of the personality traits, there is a genetic component. About 50% of who we are as individuals comes from our genes. We inherit that from our parents. But that also tells us that there's another 50% that may be under our control to some extent. And that's what SNAP is about, of what you can do to change in a positive way to improve your life. And it's clearly important because the scientific evidence is compelling that our personalities have an impact on almost every aspect of our lives, from our romantic relationships to our success in school to our annual income, our health outcomes, and even our life expectancy.
Now, see, this is fascinating, and before we get to that, what is the UCLA Longevity Center? Tell us a little bit about that.
So this is an organization that's been around for several decades, and I have had the wonderful opportunity to direct it over that time period. And we have several programs that focus on helping people to live better longer. If you talk to the average person, they will tell you, yes, I'd like to live a long time as long as I'm well. So that's what we're about. And we have memory training classes. We have a lot of innovative research that's ongoing. We've developed these healthy lifestyle programs that we've licensed all over the United States, and we're now in China and in South America. So these are very popular programs that help people live better longer.
It's fascinating, Dr. Small, because everybody, as you said, we want to live, but when we go to the doctor, when you ask that question, they say, well, when did your mother, when did your father pass away, die? Is that a good indicator?
To some extent. Just like personality, life expectancy is to some extent genetically determined. But a study performed a number of years ago, the MacArthur Study of Successful Aging, indicated that for the average person, genetics only accounts for about a third of what determines how long and how well we live. And so very much like personality, we do have more control than we realize in determining our future, our happiness, and our overall well-being.
When we talk about the book here, Snap, in kind of a tin-type fashion, how would you describe this book to somebody?
Well, this book translates very compelling new science about how we can change, and it really details how you can go about it. It gives you a real map to moving forward in your life and improving your life. And it began when I read an article that upended our understanding of personality. Now, I'm a psychiatrist, and like most mental health professionals, we were taught that your personality is pretty much set during childhood. Certainly with age, we see some mild changes. We get less anxious. We become a little wiser with age. But a major personality change is very rare. It can happen maybe with in-depth psychoanalysis for many years, or a major life experience, both a positive and negative one. But for most of us, it doesn't change that much. And what the research showed and did for the first time was to look at personality traits as outcome measures in studies that involve psychotherapy, other professional interventions, and self-help approaches. And the remarkable conclusion was that, yes, we can change our personalities in meaningful ways, improve them, and it can happen very quickly, within a month.
You know, that's fascinating, because I hear people a lot describe themselves, and they'll say things like, I just have no patience. I have a short fuse. Now, I assume these are not good personality traits. I assume the person knows that they are not good personality traits, but they don't change them. They just figure they are that way.
That's accurate, and in fact, a lot of these people do want to change. When scientists have systematically asked that question, approximately 80% of people across the lifespan want to change themselves in some way. And in SNAP, we detail this whole process of change, how a lot of people are in an early phase of change where they're still considering what they want to do. And they have a lot of ambivalence, and there are barriers, and they have lots of, actually many times they're lame excuses when they get some perspective on it, as to why they can't change. And we help people confront that, overcome those barriers to change so they can move forward and actually plan how they can change, you know, whether psychotherapy makes sense, and if so, what kind of psychotherapy. They can assess their baseline personality strengths and weaknesses, and so they can align the kind of personality change to fit in with their goals so they can make a difference in their lives.
In the period of a month, that seems so short. How do you achieve that?
Well, what we've tried to do is to translate this science into a very practical approach. So for some people, preparing to do the work can take a bit more time, you know, getting over this ambivalence, doing some planning. But the evidence is really quite compelling that once you get started with the psychotherapy or once you get started with the self-help approach and you stick with it, if you're conscientious, which of course is another helpful personality trait, in a month you're going to experience a meaningful improvement. And these studies have followed people for a year or more, and we find that those improvements are sustained even after you stop the treatment.
You know, what fascinates me, something like exercise. Now, some people love to do it. It's a stress reliever. Certainly, we think this is good for the body. They go, they do it. It's their thing. It's part of their day. Then there are people who are told they need to exercise, maybe for a weight issue or a medical condition, and they hate it so much that they not only do they not do it all the time, but they get angst about doing it. How do you get to the point to where, okay, well, I'm just going to love doing that because it's good for me?
So this can be challenging, and in SNAP we talk about how to tailor a person's program so it works for them. Now, we also talk about some of the brain changes that go on when you change your personality or change yourself in any way. And in fact, the principles can apply to any sort of change in habit, lifestyle habit, like exercise or going on a diet. And what we find from the research is that the hardest part, this is no surprise to all of us, is getting started, is getting over that initial hump. And in fact, there are parts of the brain in the frontal lobe, in the thinking brain, that fight us, that they're telling us, oh, you don't want to exercise, you know, lie down until the feeling about exercising goes away. But there's another part of the brain that knows that it's important to exercise. So you have sort of a battle of the brain. But if you can push yourself, get some support from therapy or from like-minded, healthy people, and get over that hump, that initial struggle, your brain actually changes, and it gets easier over time. And you can adjust the exercise so it can be enjoyable, so it doesn't have to be so painful. So some people like doing contact or competitive sports. That can be more fun for them than just getting on a treadmill and being bored.
You know, earlier on, before you were on, we were talking about baseball spring training. And we were talking about Tommy Lasorda. And it brings into my mind the idea of a guy who's Italian, who's always kind of been hot-headed, who's been overweight for the majority of his adult life. And yet he, I think, is going to be 91 this year and is still, as far as I know, cognitively okay and physically still getting around at 91 at least. But some people don't. If genetics is only a third, what would you expect that what happened that allowed Tommy Lasorda to live that long?
So genetics is a third on average, and you do have these unusual individuals who probably have some kind of longevity gene, which is also being studied in some centers around the country, and that overrides all these lifestyle habits that we know are important for helping us to live better longer. So for the average person, being overweight and especially having what we call central obesity, that fat we collect around the abdomen that expands the waist, if you have that in midlife, that significantly increases the likelihood of your developing dementia or Alzheimer's disease later in life, and also having a shorter life expectancy. Same is true about smoking, about eating an unhealthy diet, having chronic stress, and so forth. Now, if you if you look at the different personality traits, people who are conscientious, who are extroverted, are going to live better longer. Because if you're conscientious, you're going to follow what your doctor recommends. You're going to take your blood pressure medicine. You're going to take your medicine for high cholesterol. You're going to go on that diet. You're going to stop smoking. And if you're extroverted, you're going to have a stronger social network. And loners don't do well. People who have a lot of friends and family and socialize a lot, they live better longer.
Now, it's interesting because I've always felt that parties, for example, the most gregarious people at some of those parties, certainly back in the days when smoking was more prevalent, those were the people who were smoking more, drinking more, but they certainly were not introverted people. They weren't sitting at home doing that.
So you have, you know, all of us have a sort of a signature personality. No people, two people are exactly alike. And in the research that we describe in SNAP and in the assessments that we provide people in SNAP, we go over what's called the Big Five personality domains. And these are areas that have been shown to change with the proper intervention in a very brief period of time. So traits or domains like conscientiousness, another one is emotional stability, agreeableness, extroversion, and openness. So these are the five domains. And in each of those domains, there's going to be a range in terms of or a spectrum along which people fall. So you may be particularly gregarious and extroverted, but you may not be all that conscientious. So you may, even though you have a strong social network, you may not follow up on your doctor's suggestions and not smoke. So I think these different areas can work against each other. And in fact, a personality trait that is generally considered a positive one, like agreeableness, if it's extreme, it can be negative, because people who are too agreeable, others walk all over them, or they're scammed by others, or they can become passive aggressive, where they're really seething with anger they haven't expressed.
You know, a term I hear a lot is when there is some kind of an argument or some kind of a disagreement. I often hear this term, I don't want to rock the boat. Now, to me, that suggests maybe you don't agree with what's being said, but you're not going to say anything because you don't want to cause any strife. Now, is that bad or good?
It depends. You know, in life, you've got to choose your battles, and people who get into it with everyone never get anywhere because they're constantly fighting everyone. On the other hand, If you pick the right battles, that's going to serve you and serve the people around you. If something is not is really eating at you, it's important to know how to express your point of view without the whole situation erupting and falling apart. So, some people need some help with anger management, how to express their anger without attacking the individual, learning how to take a break, time out if things get too heated up, and come back when you're not as emotional. So it is important to confront issues as we move forward in life and not hold on to all these negative feelings.
One thing that I have seen become pervasive in the age of the internet is kind of an envious, paranoid person. Now, those type of personalities were always around, but I've noticed in the age of the internet, if you see somebody's doing good, you may put something nasty there, or you might say something nasty when you see them, or if they're doing better than you, you think, well, they must be doing something wrong. What kind of personality traits are those?
Well, those are people who would score low on agreeableness. So they like to pick fights and attack others. They are low on emotional stability, so they have a lot of self-doubt. and insecurity, and a common ineffective strategy that many people use is to put other people down, because that will boost their own ego up, and it's very ineffective and it's hurtful, and it turns people off. So you have less of a social network to protect you as you go through life.
Now, is this person going to live a long life?
It's hard to say, because that's just a snippet of who that person is. They may have other personality traits that are protective, but that is a person who could certainly benefit from a book like Snap if they're open to change and they're motivated. I mean, that's a key. You have to, if you come to me and you say to me, well, I want to change my personality because my wife thinks I'm too closed off, or my brother thinks that, you know, I'm too shy and introverted. That's not going to work. You have to be self-motivated. People joke, well, I got to get this book for my wife. I mean, I want her to change. Well, you know, the best way to help someone close to you change is for you to change yourself, because it'll trickle up and trickle down and have a positive effect on other people in your sphere, in your social sphere.
You mentioned relationships. Now, this is an interesting thing, because the research I've always seen has been that married couples live longer, and that people with pets live longer. But some people just don't. Relationships are very stressful for them. Can you live a long life and not be in a relationship?
Well, many people do, and that would mean they have a, you know, strong longevity genetic makeup, and probably some other traits that help them. But in general, loners don't live as long and don't do as well. Now, that's no reason to give up. In fact, in SNAP, we have several case studies. We show how these principles and strategies apply to different people who want to change, and several case studies of individuals who were shy or introverted, and how they use different approaches, such as cognitive behavioral therapy or psychodynamic therapy, to help them change and move forward in their lives.
You know, something that always fascinates me about couples who are married 60, 70 years, we've even seen people make it to 80 years now, usually they don't both die at the same time. And when one dies, there seem to be two cases. One, the other one follows very close behind, or the other one, where you go to that person and you say, well, don't you want to be with somebody else again? Don't you want to be in another relationship? You were in one all your life. And they say, I don't want to take care of anybody else. Which is the best outlook to have?
Well, certainly people who are resilient would have an open personality, and that's a very positive trait. And that kind of individual would be more likely to survive the death of a long-term spouse. Others do not do as well, and what you say is true. There have been studies showing that a number of people who live very long, if the husband or wife dies, they have a higher risk for dying soon after that event, because it's very hard for them to move forward. And it gets into some of the negative aspects of loneliness. It really is a predictor of shorter life expectancy.
Small personality tweaks. What are some of those?
Well, you know, it's something people can do, and in fact, that's something that almost everybody can do, is to identify an area where you'd like to improve a bit and to set a reasonable goal. It's all about not making it too difficult. If you set an unreasonable goal, you're never going to get there. You're going to get frustrated. And in fact, that's a time when you need to step back and get a perspective on what you're trying to do. You want to try to take baby steps. And I think this can be very helpful, because it will reinforce and empower people that they really can change and motivate them to tweak their personalities even more.
We all hear we hear about these people all the time, gossip. Now, I have always considered a gossip to be an extroverted person because they want to tell it. Gossip doesn't work unless there's somebody else involved. Mm-hmm. But it's usually a negative connotation. So is it good or bad to do that?
Well, it's certainly not good because, you know, what goes around comes around. You start gossiping about other people, the person you're talking to is going to be thinking, gee, do I want to share anything with this individual? Do I trust them? And it's a combination. Yes, it's extroversion, but it's also disagreeableness. And that's a negative personality trait. So when if you look at the big five, you can look at your signature personality strengths and weaknesses. And sometimes a combination, if you have extroversion, which is positive, if you combine it with some negative traits, it's not so good. In fact, extreme extroverts can be very annoying and nosy and get into other people's business. They have no boundaries, and that can be a very negative trait.
Every January 1st, we hear we're going to get a gym membership, we're going to go on a diet, and it never works. 99% of the time, you see these people in March, and nothing has changed. I think they had good intentions, but if we could change our personality by doing something, why aren't we all slim and trim and healthy, which I think we all want to be?
You know, I think it's difficult to change. It certainly is. And I think one of the difficulties is people have really not had a roadmap or a guide to do this comprehensively. So you say, well, I'm going to go on a diet or I'm going to exercise, and you get started, and you really don't have a proper support system, or you don't have reasonable goals. And if you take SNAP, it really walks you through the science, translates it into a step-by-step program, how you can create an exercise program or a diet program that really will stick and will sustain itself.
If you are somebody who says, I just love being alone, I love living alone, I like being alone, I would never want, I'm shut off to all ideas. Do they really mean that? What is that saying to somebody?
So, you know, I think that's the extreme. There are not a lot of people like that, but there are a lot of people who are introverts as opposed to extroverts. And in fact, when I talk at meetings and at public lectures about SNAP, I often ask people to show their hands. How many of you are extroverts? How many introverts? And people know right away. And in fact, about a third of the population, they are introverts. And it's not necessarily a bad thing to be an introvert. Introverts are great listeners. They're very thoughtful when they make decisions. They come home at the end of the day and they just want to relax and be by themselves, maybe read a book. An extrovert, they come home at the end of the day, they got to talk about everything that happened and so forth. And in fact, an introvert can make a relatively good partner with an extrovert because the extrovert likes to talk and the introvert likes to listen. But most introverts do have a few close friends. They may not be the most popular kid on the block, but they do have some strong friendships. And, you know, we talk about the positives of extroversion. Sometimes extroverts can come off in negative ways. They can seem self-centered or superficial. And the same with introverts. They can come off as being aloof or snobby.
You know, we've even created a colloquialism in our society. You're going to worry yourself to death. How do you train yourself not to worry?
Well, actually, there are very effective ways to do that. And in fact, that's the emotional stability domain, one of the areas of our personality that can change the most from psychotherapy. And so there are forms of psychotherapy, insight-oriented, where you try to understand what your past experiences are that maybe trigger all these worries. And with that insight, it gives you more control over it. And cognitive behavioral therapy teaches you other ways of thinking about your life, which changes how you behave and that can make a difference as well. And both have been tested over short-term periods, and if you have a goal-oriented psychotherapy, it can be very effective in reducing these kinds of symptoms.
When we look at longevity, and I think this is fascinating, when I look at family members, I say, okay, well, my grandparents lived up into their 80s and some into their 90s, but their parents only lived into their 60s. But a lot of that had to do with medicine of the time. So when I get to be 80, which is where some of them, you know, made it to, will the medicine be different and cause me to live longer? Does the change in technology, are we going to see in the next 30, 40, 50 years changes that are just purely going to allow us to live longer?
Well, that is certainly the trend. Medical technology, and not only that, healthier lifestyles have helped everybody live longer. So if you were born in 1900, you'd be lucky to reach your 50th birthday. People born today are going to live into their 80s and beyond, depending on where you live in the world. Countries with higher socioeconomic levels do better because they have better medical care. People are more educated, and they know to not smoke and to live healthy and to watch their weight and so forth. So I think we're living longer. The problem is our bodies and our brains were not engineered to live that long. And so we suffer from, even though we survive, we still suffer from age-related illnesses like heart disease, cancer, and Alzheimer's disease.
I want to get into memory because I think this is a huge thing. But before I do that, what has always puzzled me, the grandparents' parents, let's say they died in the 40s, 50s, and 60s, decades in our lifetime, 1940s, 50s, and 60s. There are no McDonald's. There are no Taco Bell. There is not a lot of soda pop on the shelf. We certainly eat worse now, but we live longer.
So, you know, you have conflicting trends over the years. On the positive side, helping people to live longer are the medications. I mean, just taking your blood pressure medicine, your cholesterol medicine, will add years to your life. The knowledge about lifestyle, regular physical exercise will add years to your life, protect your brain from Alzheimer's, so forth. So we have that on the positive side, and on the negative side are the fast food restaurants, the sedentary lifestyle. So it's a tension, and it's a problem we're seeing more and more. There are countries around the world where people were living longer and better, but with the introduction of these Western lifestyles, that trend changes.
Alzheimer's and dementia is a big issue here in longevity, I believe, because there seems to be no cure for Alzheimer's at this point. There seems to be no real cure for dementia. And usually this hits you. If you die young, you don't have this problem. But if you live 70s, 80s, 90s, you a lot of more people develop this. First of all, let's start from the base. What is the difference between Alzheimer's and dementia from a brain perspective?
Well, I mean, really, those terms, it's not just the brain. Excuse me, it's behavior. So dementia is a memory or other cognitive impairment that interferes with the person's independence. And there are a lot of different causes of that. You can get a dementia from a medication side effect or from strokes in the brain. The most common cause of dementia is Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease is defined as a gradual accumulation of abnormal protein deposits in the brain called plaques and tangles that accumulate in areas that control thinking and memory. And about two-thirds of dementias are caused by Alzheimer's disease. Age is the greatest single risk factor for dementia and Alzheimer's disease. By age 65 or older, a person's risk is about 10%. By age 85 or older, it approaches 50%.
I notice that when a lot of people who live long lives get up into their 80s and 90s,
A lot of time, the conversation that comes up is the kids will take the driver's license. And I'm not sure this is dementia or Alzheimer's. They're just afraid. Reflexes, memory about directions, safety precautions are not as good as they were. But that doesn't necessarily mean dementia or Alzheimer's, does it?
Yeah, if you lose your driver's license, it's based on function, that people around you are noticing you're having problems, you're getting more accidents, you're becoming forgetful. Another problem as people age, their reaction time slows down. So, you know, we want to make it safe for people, but losing the license doesn't necessarily tell you what the specific diagnosis is.
Well, I know we have to have specific diagnosis here, but what I seem to notice is that as people get older, the parents or the kids become the parents of the parents.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And they start treating them more like a child. But I just don't know if that memory loss is it normal when you hit 80, 90? To have some memory issues?
It is normal. Actually, by the time we're in our mid-40s, we have a decline in memory compared to in our 20s. And it's we call it normal aging, where you forget where you put your keys or you forget someone's name and it comes back to you later. That's a gradual process. It generally doesn't interfere with our ability to drive or to function in daily life. Now, for some people, because of their genetic risk or because of their unhealthy lifestyle, that normal aging memory decline accelerates and it gets into an area where it does interfere with their lives and interferes with their driving abilities, and that becomes a problem, and we need to make it safe for not just the patient but for everyone else.
Absolutely, and I think it's interesting because people between their 80s and their 90s, I see them in nursing homes and places of that nature, maybe assisted living, and I'm not sure, you're never sure because you're not their doctor, but I'm never sure if they've had Alzheimer's or they have dementia. I've seen Alzheimer's in advanced stages, and, people can't remember how to use a spoon or a fork. And then there's people who I see who just... they forgot people they didn't see often. They forgot things like that, said weird things,
right.
But it never progressed.
Well, if you look at the epidemiology of this, you're talking about, if you're talking about people on average who are 85, about 50% of them have dementia, and about 70% of those dementias are due to Alzheimer's. Now, the reality is most people don't have a pure Alzheimer's dementia. If you follow people to autopsy, you find many of them also have small strokes in the brain or evidence of head trauma. So it can be a very mixed bag. And this is quite interesting to me because my main area of research has been in brain aging and memory decline. And this new book on SNAP and how you can change your personality, it does have an impact on your risk for developing these devastating dementias as we age.
And that's where I want to go. How do we stop that if we are 30, 40, 50 now and we have our mind? What should we avoid?
Well, let's start with the positive. You should be exercising on a regular basis. So 15 minutes of brisk walking can lower your risk for Alzheimer's disease. You should be eating a Mediterranean-style diet and not eating the fast food so much and avoiding those French fries and the processed foods and refined sugars. You should be managing your stress as best as you can. In SNAP, we talk about meditation, how it can help people become emotionally stable. Short meditations, you can get an app on your smartphone that will help you meditate 10 minutes a day, which our scientists have found not only improves mood, but improves memory and may even improve life expectancy. And we also teach memory techniques, ways to compensate for declining memory, and that's the content of these classes that our Longevity Center has available to the public.
Is there any way to stop progression or reverse the effects in a person who is already in their 80s and 90s?
Well, certainly the earlier we help people or get involved, the more we can help them. It's easier to protect a healthy brain than to repair one that has extensive damage. Now, we've seen some remarkable results when we get people on a lifestyle strategy early on and then start them on memory medicines or Alzheimer medicines when they get to the stage of dementia, and they can sustain a much higher level of functioning longer. Reversal of the process, we're not there yet, and there are still a lot of studies we're doing and others are doing to try to see if we can have a disease-modifying effect on Alzheimer's and related conditions.
Before we move away from this section, is there a way to diagnose Alzheimer's that's not horrible, that's not autopsy?
Well, yeah, I think we have much better methods of diagnosis. It's something you can't self-diagnose. So if you you go online and you try to take the Alzheimer's test, it might give you a sense of how bad your memory is when you assess it. But you really need to see a doctor to find out what's going on with your memory. So it's very important if you are concerned about your memory or someone else's that you see the doctor. It may not be Alzheimer's. It could just be a medication side effect. Or sometimes somebody's depressed and it comes off as a memory deficit. And even if it is Alzheimer's, the sooner you get started on symptomatic medicines and a healthy lifestyle approach, the better your outcome in the long run.
Being somebody who might be listening right now who is an advocate for somebody who might have these issues, is there a physical way that a doctor can go in, not just by asking questions and say, okay, yes, you have Alzheimer's, you don't?
Well, the assessment involves getting a good history from the family. So with Alzheimer's, it would be a gradual progression. If the person had a sudden onset of change, it would be more likely to be a depression or a stroke in the brain. The doctor will look for medical problems that could cause confusion. The doctor will take some blood tests to see if there's an abnormal thyroid or anemia. They'll do a brain scan to see if there's strokes and so forth. So it's kind of a process of elimination. And if all those turn out negative and the course is consistent with Alzheimer's, then you make a diagnosis of probable Alzheimer's disease.
Last question on this. Recently, without saying the person's name, I was with somebody and they did a CAT scan and the doctor said shrinkage of the brain. And I kept thinking, what in the world does that mean? Does the brain shrink as you get older?
It does. Actually, we call it atrophy, and that's a normal part of aging, and that doesn't make a diagnosis of Alzheimer's. Now, there are some brain scans, PET scans, that look at the function of brain cells, and you can see patterns that will be consistent with the diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. They're not routinely recommended, but in some situations, actually Medicare will pay for those scans, particularly to differentiate Alzheimer's disease from another kind of dementia called frontal temporal dementia.
Mm. We got about 4 minutes left here. What a fascinating conversation. Gary Small, the director of UCLA Longevity Care, author of SNAP, Challenge Your Personality in 30 Days. Okay, doctor, with about 4 minutes left here, If I am in my 30s, 40s, or 50s right now, what does my personality need to be so I can see the year 3000?
Well, I think, you have to find out what it is right now. So you may, you do a personality assessment in SNAP, and you may find out that you're introverted, and you're also not open to new experiences, and you're a little bit emotionally unstable. But let's say you want to, and you're also too agreeable. You got to break up your boyfriend who doesn't want to have a family because you want to have a family, and you want to go out and meet new people, well, that might involve becoming a little bit less agreeable. So you could confront your boyfriend who doesn't want to have a family and get him to move out. And then because you're introverted, you might want to become a bit more extroverted. So in that kind of situation, you have an idea of what your personality changes ought to be to meet your specific goal. So it really is about who you are now, what your goals are, and how you can alter certain personality traits to achieve your goals.
Something that a lot of people talk about, heart attack, stroke, diabetes, those things, lung issues, pneumonia, we think those are related to exercise, diet, we know that. But so many people die of cancer. Does personality, the way you act in life, play a part in cancer?
Well, that's certainly an interesting question, and it certainly could play a part. If your cancer is related to lifestyle risk factors. So if you take lung cancer, we know that smoking increases the risk for lung cancer. And you may be a smoker, and you may not be that conscientious and not following through in your doctor's recommendation to stop smoking. Well, if you improved your level of conscientiousness, you may be able to stop smoking, and that could save your life.
But pancreatic cancer, prostate cancer, ovarian cancer, is it just the luck of the draw, some genetics involved there?
Well, all these cancers, just like Alzheimer's disease, there's a mixture of genetics and lifestyle. So whatever you can do to change your personality, to live a healthier lifestyle, it's going to help your health outcomes. There's no question about it.
Does it help your recovery?
You know, there's not been a study that has systematically looked at that, but we could infer that, yes, it would help your recovery if there are certain aspects of your recovery that require personality change. So if you have to do new things and you're a closed-off person, helping yourself to become more open to new approaches could improve your outcome.
Dr. Gary Small, the director of UCLA Longevity Care, author of a book, boy, this is fascinating, it could change your life, SNAP, Change Your Personality in 30 Days. Dr. Small, I hope you come back with us because it's been fascinating.
It would be a pleasure. Enjoy the conversation.
Thank you, doctor.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Dr. Small. And that's it for us today. Remember the big announcement tomorrow at 12:15. David Newell, Mr. McFeely, tune in for this day. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
Over there, okay. For people listening, you know, something that came in that would have been huge.
A huge.